Coming up today, the virtual reality future of cinema and why we all need to get ready for a super volcano explosion. You're listening to episode 345 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. This episode is brought to you by John Lewis's Star Wars Toys Collection. With battling X-Wing drones, app-controlled droids and codable R2-D2s, there's something for everyone. Head to your nearest John Lewis store or search Star Wars on the John Lewis website. Welcome, I'm your host James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
And Sian Bradley.
Hello.
Let's start, as we always do, with a fact. Matt.
I have the opposite of a fact, a question.
Okay.
A two-part question, right? So what year had the highest number of UK cinema admissions? And for a bonus point, how many admissions were they? So how many people went to see a film?
How far are we going back? How many years?
Oh, the history of cinema. So like, I don't know, 1910s or 20s, whatever it is.
Okay. I reckon it was 1982.
Okay, and how many people saw a film? This is total number of films watched, so, you know, the figure might be more than the number of people in the UK.
400 million.
Okay, Sian?
See, I was thinking, like, the 50s was very cinematic, but everyone was probably still too poor then. I'll just go 1955.
Uh-huh.
How many, like, in the world?
No, in the UK.
In the UK. Yeah, I'll score like 10 million.
Okay, so you're saying like maybe, you know, 20% of people saw a film in that year. The year was 1946.
Whoa.
So, Sian, you're pretty close. The number of people or number of cinema visits that happened in that year, it was, I wrote on a little scrap of paper that I've dropped.
Now I've jotted it on the floor. Do, do, do.
It was 1.63 billion.
Whoa.
Cinema admissions in that year.
So
that was
everyone went because it was...
Well, everyone went over and over and over again, like, you know, hundreds of times. I mean, this is back in the days where I think every film was basically a double admission. You'd see, like, double headers every time.
I see.
But, I mean, still, that is so many.
Why do you've written it down on, like, a cube of paper. It's really odd.
Of cards.
I know. It was the only thing I had in my pocket.
Okay, great. Cool. Well, there we go. Sian, what did you learn this week?
So I learned today that there's evidence of 2,000-year-old graffiti, so in the ancient city of Pompeii, and there's a whole list of it that you can find. And it's, yeah, there's some that's not really safe for podcasts, but there was one that is pretty great. All it said was, on April 19th, I made bread.
So it's Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a very early tweet.
Nice.
It's cool. It's just always existed. Some of them were like, yeah, why is my son sleeping with all the women and... Weird, strange. Yeah.
Weird thing to spray paint on a wall. I guess they weren't spray painting, doing whatever they did.
It's the early blog, you know? They didn't know what else to do.
Yeah, they were vlogging with chisels. I learned that echidnas don't have nipples.
What do they... How do they milk?
They sweat.
They sweat milk?
They sweat milk through a couple of patches in their pouches.
That's quite lovely, isn't
it? Yeah. Is this like human sweating?
Sort of, yeah. They have these weird sort of glandy things that aren't nipples. They're not proper. Yeah, so they just sweat out of these patches in their pouches.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's good alternative.
Echidnas.
How did you find that out?
Oh, well, this is such a... That's a great follow-up question. So we mentioned it before. We're doing Animal Battle, where we battle some of the world's weirdest creatures against each other in a virtual... I don't know, fight to the death? It's not really. It's a fight for the animal that you think is the weirdest and the most wonderful and the coolest or the deadliest. And this week it's echidna versus Greenland shark.
I'm team echidna.
Yeah, same.
I'm team Greenland shark.
Right, I'll give a quick spiel about the echidna and then people can head to Twitter or Facebook to vote. So echidnas, they're one of only two egg-laying mammals along with a platypus. The male has a four-headed penis, which it rotates between matings, between two of the heads and then two of the heads. They sweat milk. Their babies are called puggles.
That's cute.
What else is weird about echidnas? Lordy lord. I mean, they lay eggs. I mean, that's, yeah.
Poison that isn't poison.
Yeah, they have a poison spur that isn't poisonous. They're cute.
I mean, it's good, But Greenland sharks, they can live to over 400 years old. So there could be sharks alive today that were, you know, born the same time as Shakespeare. They snack on kind of, they wait, they basically wait for animals to fall off the ice shelf and then kind
quite
of like
lazy.
Eat them. They have these tiny parasite crustacean things that latch into their eye and then basically eat their eyeballs. So basically most of them are blind, but they have a really good sense of smell. So that's how they find the reindeer. And they're poisonous. Their flesh is toxic. And it smells like cleaning fluid, and it's actually a delicacy in Iceland because you have to bury it for like 3 months and then hang it to dry for another 3 months. And that's a, yeah, it's a delicacy.
Head to Wired's Facebook and Twitter pages to pick your favourite. Team Echidna, just saying. Our first story this week is about the future of cinema, as we alluded to a little earlier and with Matt's quiz question. Matt, you have tasted the future of cinema. How is it?
It's like slightly nausea inducing.
It tastes like sick.
Yeah, it tastes like sick.
Oh dear.
Yeah, so basically, so I went to Manchester in the north of England to go to this kind of this VR experience, basically. So IMAX, you know, that company that makes those super big screens, to, you know, all those, you know, really like immersive blockbusters. They've opened their first European IMAX VR centre. What this actually means is that in the lobby of the Odeon in a shopping centre, just outside Manchester, or kind of in Manchester, there are 10 pods where you can strap on a HTC Vive headset and, you know, also put on this kind of weird vibrating backpack thing, and you can pay £7.50 to get into virtual reality.
But for minutes, so this is about a sort of 8 to 10 minute VR experience, and you're paying £7.50 for it.
Yeah, that's right. So it's kind of expensive. I mean, honestly,
it's kind of expensive.
Yeah. I mean, it's a kind of like hourly rate. Yeah. So the whole idea behind this really is trying to get more people into cinemas. And I think the idea, I was talking to people at Odeon and IMAX that kind of brought this into Europe. And they were basically saying the idea is, you know, if we've got Justice League on at the minute, why not also have the Justice League VR thing? And we've got the Star Trek film coming up next year.
Okay.
And you got that as well, you know, VR experience. So it's all about kind of like, well, a couple of things, really. One, you know, can we offer people enough so they might go to the cinema instead of just waiting for it to come out on Netflix, whatever?
Yeah.
Or two, can we squeeze a little bit extra out of them while they're at the cinema?
Going to the cinema is already expensive anyway. Mm. I mean, it's especially, you know, I grew up in the sticks and it was sort of £2 or £3. But in London, you're often paying £10 just to watch a film. It's a little bit ridiculous. And it will be the same in a lot of cities around the world. I know going to the cinema is a lot cheaper in America and Canada, but in the UK, generally, it's quite expensive these days. So asking people to pay an extra £7.50 on top of that visit to the cinema is asking quite a bit. So we'll get into the future of cinema later and have a bit of a chinwag about that. But what were the experiences actually like? You tried out a couple.
Yeah, so they're quite cool. So I tried out two of them. There's actually about like six or seven new experiences. So the first one I tried was a, you know, it's your classic robot shooty. So, you know, you're in a headset, you know, you've got, you know, I mean, if you've ever used a VR, you know, if you use the Vive before, you know, you have kind of two controllers and they've got triggers on and you can kind of, you know, you shoot robots. You know, it's like being in an arcade game. It's cool, right? It doesn't, you know, blow my mind. The other thing I tried was this Justice League tie-up. And like I said, like a lot of these things are going to be tie-ups with big blockbuster films.
Yeah.
And you could be either Batman or Superman. If you're Superman, you kind of flew through the sky chasing these weird bat things. I don't know why, like these weird kind of pterodactyl things. But you're also in this kind of like chair. So it was all, you know, it was vibrating if you kind of hit stuff and it was like tilting back. And to fly forward, you had to kind of thrust your arms out in front of you. It honestly, I mean, I must have looked like an absolute idiot. But you know, that was it was fun.
But as kids, we all went to the arcades, right? Like I grew up on the seaside, so you go down and you play the penny slots or whatever, and it was all, well, not penny slots, we weren't gambling. What's the thing where you put in the 2p's and it never knocks off the 2p's?
I always call them 2p machines.
Yeah, penny machines, whatever. Yeah. You know, we'd all do that, and this is just an evolution of that, right?
I mean, I think so. I mean, as you know, as far as I could tell, I mean, is this the kind of future cinema? No. Is this a kind of like nice gimmicky thing that, you know, you might do when you go to cinema? Maybe. I don't think you could fill 10 of them.
Mm.
I think the thing is, right, is that if we're thinking about the future of cinema, cinema viewing has kind of like stagnated a little bit, but maybe that's like not such a bad thing, because not every film needs like a massive cinema release. And I kind of wonder if actually we kind of like might reach this stage where some films you go to watch at the cinema, you know, like a really amazing blockbuster or like Gravity or whatever, but you know what, I'm kind of okay with, you know, like your generic drama.
Yeah, this is a really good point. So I saw Gravity. So this was filmed for 3D. It's an amazing visual spectacle. I saw it for the first time on a tiny screen on a plane. And it completely loses all of its impact. You're like, what's happening there? It's kind of, it's all dark, and you just don't get any of the oomph. And everyone that I'd spoken to as well, it's an amazing film. I was like, didn't really get it. It only makes sense on those big screens. Films like Blade Runner that are filmed 2049, that are filmed specifically for the IMAX format, and an awful lot of Christopher Nolan films are filmed for IMAX, and they look amazing. Surely that's the future of cinema. It's making cinema as good as it can be, not tacking on a £7.50 VR experience, right?
I've always only gone to the cinema for something I really want to see. Maybe when I was younger, not so much, but now, I would only go if there was something I really, really wanted to see.
Yeah.
I think that's right for most people, because it's so expensive now. So to try and lure me in by asking me to pay more just is not going to make me go more often. And also, I'm curious, it's not even really an important part of it, but do you do it before or after the film?
Honestly, I think that's a really important thing, right? Because I don't know if you ever found this, but if you ever go to like a really big wide format film, do you ever find like shaky camera and stuff is like it like makes you a little bit sick if you're too close to the screen?
It's pretty intense. Yeah,
and like it's even worse in virtual reality. So you know, like virtual reality motion sickness is quite a well-documented thing now. So I did two of these experiences probably 10 minutes apart from each other. And when I got out, the people from IMAX were like, great, you know, what one do you want to do next? And I was like, honestly, I don't want to do another one. I feel sick. I mean, I don't think you're going to spend 15 quid or 20 quid to do two. I really think you're probably going to be doing one. But I think, you know, realistically, this is not more than a really short thing, because it's still uncomfortable, right? It's heavy, hurts your eyes.
And if you think of it, I agree, it's an interesting point, right? Do you do it before or after? Because you think of going to the cinema as a social occasion, right? So you maybe go with a couple of mates or your partner. So if you do it before, you mean you have to work out how much earlier do you go to the cinema? Film's already 2 hours long, 2.5 hours with the adverts that they chuck before it, and then you're going to want to go and get food. A lot of cinemas let you order sit-down food at your seat. You might want to get a beer or something, and then you're doing this as well. So where do you fit it into the experience, and how does it make any sense?
And also, doesn't it just like lose the magic for some films? Like, I get maybe with like Marvel and things, but yeah, you've just watched this, so you wouldn't want to do it first for all those reasons, but also you're about to watch this film that you really want to get immersed in, but first you're going to have a different version of it as a game. So for me, that would just be like, that just removes all kind of immersive opportunities for the actual film.
I'm going to go out on a limb here. As an inquisitive journalist, you put some of these questions to them.
Yes, I did.
What was, because we're all sort of agreeing with each other, which is a little boring. So what's the counter to why this is a good idea?
So I think the counter is that, well, there's a couple of things. One is, you know, in terms of innovation in cinema, I think it's fair to say that IMAX probably is one of the brands that actually is doing stuff differently and actually kind of introducing new formats to people. And so it makes sense for IMAX at least to do this, right? To say, well, this is a thing in how people consume entertainment. We should be there and at least be doing it. They're not saying, you know, to be honest, speaking to them, they're not saying this is the future of everything. They're saying, look, we're going to offer it alongside it because we think that it's significant, it adds to the experience. They're also saying, like, you know, to be honest, when it comes to a really big blockbuster like Justice League or something, you know, people want tie-ins. People would be willing to, I don't know, you know, buy the kind of like branded games or whatever that come alongside it. So I think that it's, you know, they kind of spoke about this as a kind of like natural extension of kind of franchises, and I think that it lends itself so well to stuff like Star Trek, stuff like Transformers, you know, films that are possibly not great, but are probably still, you know, it's their bread and butter, right? These are the films
Do not put Star Trek and Star Wars in with things like Transformers. Come on now.
Franchises.
Yes.
And so this is kind of their point, really, right? So they're experimenting with, they've got five of these VR centres around the globe, mostly in America at the minute. And really they're saying, look, we're not really sure about the pricing. We think it might be a better idea if, say, you buy a Justice League ticket, maybe you do the VR experience for £2 or something.
Yeah.
So they are quite kind of like open and flexible about it. They're not, you know, raving about it like this is going to be everything. So, hey, if it was an extra £2, right, on top of a ticket already... Yeah, That'd be fun, right?
But the main thing that makes it a rubbish idea is it's way too expensive at the moment. Where you know, a lot of these cinemas now have premium seats where you get a little bit more leg room, a little bit more butt room. Yeah. You might get like drinks brought to your seat for a discounted rate or whatever it is. So why not just chuck this in as well and say, okay, if people are willing to pay £18, say, to go and see a film, and it's just like having a night out and you have a little bit to eat, you have a little bit to drink, you watch a film, and you get to feel slightly queasy doing a VR experience alongside it, then hey ho, it's more fun. Some people will go for it, other people just be like, nah, give me the film and I'll sneak in a packet of crisps or whatever.
That's me. But it is interesting, isn't it? Because when I spoke to kind of Odeon, they were saying, and we've got like recliner seats and we've got, you know, to your seat thing, and it's this whole kind of thing that it seems that the route that cinema has gone down, or you know, at least our big chain cinemas, is saying, well, probably the films aren't enough, right? So we need to layer stuff on top of it. Whereas, you know, that's only one way of seeing it, isn't it? Because like other independent cinemas say, well, actually, we're going to just concentrate on the film. We're going to
go big on the film.
Yeah, we're going to curate our film selection more. And I'm not really a fan of this whole, like, get your nachos and get your hot dog, because I think it's kind of like, you know, it's a bit weird, right? As if you're sitting next to them.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting to see that your big chains have really thought, we layer stuff on and that'll bring people in. And I honestly, I don't know if it's working.
So long as there's choice, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If you have your good independent local cinema that does films really well, and then you have the big blockbuster cinema that does all the other stuff on top, there's something for everyone. And as you say, they're experimenting a bit. So there you go. If you live in Manchester, you can go and try it out right now.
Yeah, you can, yeah.
Cool. Well, maybe not. second story this week is about super volcanoes and how they're going to kill us all, or not, but probably will.
Yes. So super volcanoes, it's a very colloquial term. So let me begin by saying that no one on this earth has ever witnessed a super eruption from a super volcano.
Nor would you
Both
want
super.
To.
No, you don't want to, because the last one that happened was 74,000 years ago in Indonesia at Toba. And just to kind of get an idea of what would happen, you've got to imagine what you would imagine would happen if an asteroid hit the Earth. So you've watched films with things like these happening, and that is pretty much, it's the same kind of deal. It's just hitting something with a lot of impact into the Earth is going to chuck up a lot of ash into the atmosphere.
So it's a cataclysmic event. It's the sort of thing that's going to change climates. It's going to stop crops from growing. It's going to block out the sun. And we've had an awful lot of excitement about, as you say, asteroid impacts. And there's lots of research going into identifying asteroids that might be on a collision course with the Earth so that we can maybe do something about it. But it turns out that an awful lot closer to home, and we know where these super volcanoes are, there is a risk, albeit a teeny tiny little one.
Yeah, so it's very tiny. So there's no one saying that it's going to happen tomorrow, or if it's even going to happen in the next 1,000 or 10,000 years. No one's really sure, but you know, they can't rule it out, but they are certain that it's not going to be a very thing, something in our lifetime at least.
Yeah.
But I don't personally think that doesn't mean that we should just rule out any plans to stop it. And that's what NASA thought. So you might be wondering why NASA got involved with super volcanoes, but it's because of this asteroid thing. So super volcanoes were actually seen as just as big of a threat to civilization as asteroids are. So the planetary defense team at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California decided, hey, why don't we just look into the possibility of whether we actually would be capable of stopping this giant thing from erupting.
Right. So the plan for asteroids, I mean, there's a number of plans. You could nudge one off course, you could blow it up, things like that. And for super volcanoes, it's arguably, well, it almost definitely is a lot more difficult. So they looked at one in particular, right, which is Yellowstone, probably the most famous one.
Yeah, so they use Yellowstone as an example. Before we get going with the juiciness of the plan, Yellowstone is a super volcano, but it's also a hotspot volcano. So you wouldn't go to the Yellowstone National Park and see a peak of a volcano. It's actually just underneath the ground, and all the really pretty geysers and all the what are they called?
Hot pools?
Yeah, that's
a geyser.
Pools, the geysers, yeah, the you're geysers doing, and the pretty hot pools.
You're miming a geyser.
Yes, that's the really good for a podcast. So they're actually being caused by a supervolcano eruption. So what we actually see now in the Yellowstone is a caldera, which is just this giant depression in the earth that's caused by magmatic explosion. So,
when so it's you almost have, like a hole in the earth.
Yeah, so it's caused a hole in the earth, and that hole in the earth has been left with loads of these geothermal things, and that is the supervolcano. It doesn't actually have boundaries.
Yeah.
So to try and cool that down, which is something that's magma is literally coming from the center of the earth and coming out in these geysers, it's yeah, I mean, it's how do you do that? So they suggested maybe you could drill water in there to try and cool it down. But they were in no way saying this was a plan. They understand that if you do that, the pipes could erode because it's so acidic. It could cause more earthquakes, and it could, yeah, it could just, you don't know what's going on in there, basically.
One of the weird things is it could end up making geezers, geysers, potato, potato, like pop up all over the place in unexpected areas.
Yeah, which, you know, not really great. The good thing was the reason they were looking into it is because it would be able to produce geothermal energy, which is really clean, cheap energy that is used to power homes in Iceland. Mm-hmm. So hypothetically, feasibly, they thought they could use Yellowstone to be this new clean energy. But they have tried this in Naples before, a similar thing, but they tried to do it very, very quickly, and that meant that after 500 metres down, the well broke, and they were
trying to tap the volcano for energy, or they were trying to.
They were trying to release. So the point of drilling is basically to reduce stress of the volcano and release some of the heat, because the only way to stop the Yellowstone erupting is to cool it down, and to do so would take about 50,000 years. So it's not a short job. It's in for the long haul.
Yeah, so we were talking about this a little bit in the office as you've been researching this story, and it was either someone was speaking to you or you put the point that 50 or so years ago, if someone said to you, or maybe 100 years or so, if someone said to you, we'll be able to knock a huge city-sized rock off its course if it were to collide with Earth, people would be like, what? What's a rocket? Whereas now we've landed on the moon, we have plans to land on Mars, so now we've got the very, very early speculative academic research going on to see, is there a way that we can control super volcanoes? But there are risks associated with it, and it's super early days.
Yeah, so this is more just trying to open up a bit of a conversation and exploring into it, because quite scarily, weirdly, asteroid impacts happen half as often as super volcanic eruptions. So when we talk about the fact that only Yellowstone has only erupted three times in 2.1 million years, you know, we're talking about big timescales here. Like, we are very inferior in this timescale, which is why it's just, I think, important to just start speculating about this, because if it is going to take so many thousands of years to cool it down, and it could erupt in so many X thousands of years, you know, maybe something to think about.
Yeah, there's a certain responsibility that the media has here not to do the whole kind of scaremongering-y thing. These are very low probability events, but were they to happen, they'd have a very high impact. But it always happens that it's turned into killer volcanoes.
This is the interesting thing, because I don't know, I don't know if you've come across the Open Philanthropy Project, was this kind of like, you know, these Silicon Valley, one of the Facebook co-founders that did this, you know, kind of this philanthropic foundation. And one of their research areas is like this big disaster mitigation, because the whole idea being, well, if there's this disaster that could literally put an end to the human race, I mean, maybe a super volcano wouldn't be on quite that scale, but it'd be massive. It actually makes just as much sense to channel resource into that now, you know, because you're saving 10 billion lives in 1,000 years, as opposed to, you know, saving however many lives now. It's a really dispassionate way of looking at charity, but people are actually thinking, well, practically, maybe it's like a more efficient thing to research.
It's not very Silicon Valley attitude.
Yeah, it's so Silicon Valley, horrible.
But there was a geologist who works in Naples in Italy who looks at the Campi Flegrei, which is a terrible way of saying it, so I'm just going to skip over it quickly. But it's similar to Yellowstone, basically, and he was making a similar point that people don't really care about it because we don't think it's going to affect us, and it's not going to affect us now, but he's like, you know, it will. If we still want to be on the Earth in thousands and thousands of years' time, then we're going to want to stop that erupting.
And scientists will talk a lot about unexpected consequences, which is a good thing. So you start researching something, you put money behind some scientific work, and the things that come out of it aren't the things that you're expecting. So you don't set off down a path to cure cancer. Well, you do, but you're not working directly at that goal. You're going down all sorts of dead ends and tangents, and you come up with all sorts of things. So people point to things like the space program was a thing that ended up with, I think it's ballpoint pens came out of it. The unintended consequences, Velcro, I think, was another one that the Russians maybe invented for use in space to stop things from flying around all over the place in spacecraft. So it's all these little things that are both kind of whimsical and just useful, but also life-changing, that come out of these out of scientific research. So if, to take the example of tapping them for geothermal energy, which they already do really successfully in Iceland, mm-hmm. if they're able to come up with sustainable ways of doing that at supervolcanoes, then, well, then the Earth kind of powers itself, right? We've got this yeah. huge resource of energy. So in amongst all of the scaremongering and the vague silliness, there's some really serious science going on here, right? That's mm-hmm. that might lead to some really, really important breakthroughs in unexpected areas.
Yeah, it's just sort of not taking it as a tomorrow thing, just being able to cast your mind really into it's a multi-generational thing.
Yeah.
And just trying to imagine, really. I think it's more of a what if we could, as humans, have the power to stop this giant supervolcano from destroying the Earth.
Or at least have plans to mitigate against it,
yeah.
right? So it might be completely unrealistic, but you might be able to do something
yeah.
if you know it's going to erupt. You might be able to sort of develop a plan. So we're going to be publishing this story over the weekend with a bit of luck. Sian, you've still got a bit more reporting to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really cool area and not something that you'd imagine NASA would be involved in. But
no.
There you go. They get involved in all sorts of things. Our final section of the podcast this week, quiz time. Happy Black Friday, everyone. Yep, so we're recording this on Friday, the 24th of November, which is also known as Black Friday. It's the happiest day of the year.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it really?
Silence speaks volumes.
Yeah. For the uninitiated, Black Friday is the first shopping day after Thanksgiving in the United States. It's also celebrated in quite a few other countries, especially Canada and the UK, but also in an awful lot of markets, mainly thanks to a certain online retailer. We'll get onto that a little later. So how much do you know about Black Friday?
Probably more than I'd ever want to, but that's very little.
Yes, yes. It is a remarkable phenomenon. So why is, question one, why is Black Friday called Black Friday?
Ooh, I think I heard a bit of this earlier. So I feel like I might. It's something to do with people getting trampled or something.
Okay.
In a stampede.
So it's like it's a
like
dark.
Like in a Walmart.
It's a dark day.
Yes.
It's a black day.
So I read that, you know, like, you're like, profits are in the red to mean that things are like declining. Mm-hmm. That this is like Amazon's profits are in the black, which just sounds like a terrible way to name it. So I don't think that's true, but
you're right.
They're yeah. so bad. Like,
yeah. So it's
so cynical.
So it dates back to the 50s and the 60s when retailers started to take advantage of this national holiday across the United States. There's people that are full of Thanksgiving food and have been given Thanksgiving money or whatever, and they want to go off a bit like Boxing Day, people might recognize in other countries. So yeah, they saw it as an opportunity to go from red to black.
I mean, isn't that, and Profit Loss Wednesday, it's like such a kind of like corporate thing that's just been adopted.
You're aware of what Black Friday is.
I know, I shouldn't be shocked really, should
yeah.
I?
But okay,
still.
So 1-0 Matt Reynolds. Since 2006, how many Americans have lost their lives as a direct result of going shopping on Black Friday?
Like 150 or something? More, I'm, maybe. Oh, I don't know.
Oh, I know, because I bet this is like shootings. Guns are silly. It must be less than that. It has to be, like, I'm going to say 55.
It's way less
oh.
than either
damn.
Of those. I mean, you are closest.
Oh.
So I'll give you a point. It's 10.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well, I mean, well.
Yeah. I'm, we're pessimistic,
yeah,
aren't we?
I'm, yeah. Wow.
So 105 people have been injured. Most of the deaths are either car accidents, so people falling asleep at the wheel or just driving recklessly. There's been a few shootings. They're all tragic because people died completely unnecessarily. In 2008, a worker at a Long Island Walmart died after being trampled in a Black Friday stampede. Yeah, it's a hell of a thing. So question three. Until recently, the term Black Friday had a different meaning in the UK. What was it? So that's until we adopted the American tradition, if you like.
I can only ever remember sales.
Well, I was going to say, so, like, black, there was a thing, right, in the Wall Street crash, and that was like Black Tuesday or Wednesday or something.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there was like a UK equivalent.
Okay.
So I'm going to say it was some kind of economic downturn,
mm-hmm.
maybe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Sean?
Oh, I literally have no idea. I can only ever remember it being to do with sales. I'm going to blame my age.
Cool. All right. So neither of you get a point. The term Black Friday originated within the police and the NHS to refer to the Friday before Christmas. It's the day when emergency services activate contingency plans to cope with the increase in workload due to the number of people who go out drinking and get a little bit mangled.
When did they stop using that?
So I presume they still do. So there were news reports written sort of around the 2007-8 times until quite recently, before it became the American event over here, where I think a BBC headline was Cardiff Police Activate Black Friday Plan in response to drunken misbehaviour.
All their trampling teams are now on.
There you go. So when did the American Black Friday tradition make its way to the UK? What year?
2003.
I think that I was sentient, so I'm going to say a bit later. I think maybe like...
Love it. Before that, what? You were just some sort of amoeba.
Yeah, I didn't activate until much later. I'm going to say maybe like 2011. I feel like it's
recent. A bit later than that, actually.
It's too late now.
I know. Well. Yeah.
2010.
Okay.
Yep. Oh, yep. Matt Reynolds 3-0. It's all over. Yep.
Wow.
So it was 2010 in the UK, thanks to Amazon. They brought it over as the Black Friday sales week. So they had a week of time deals really ramp up the excitement. The first large-scale bricks and mortar Black Friday in the UK was in 2013, courtesy of Asda, which is owned by Walmart. Yeah. So Walmart had the Walmart Black Friday by Asda.
That's where I'm getting the 3 from.
There you go.
I knew there was a 3 in there somewhere.
Finally, for pride, more than anything, what is Cyber Monday?
It's the Monday after Black Friday.
Bingo. Yep. There you go. You mean you can have a guess, but no, you're not going to get a point. Yeah, it's the first Monday after Thanksgiving. It was coined in 2005 when online retailers noticed that many people didn't have time to shop over the holiday weekend, maybe because they had better things to do. But when they got back to work the next week, they're like, got to get some deals. So they'd head online. And that then became Cyber Monday, which is now becoming Cyber Week, which will soon become just a period of endless sales that run all the way from late November to December.
Mm-hmm. Yay.
Yay. Yay indeed. I mean, it turns out that the actual shape of Black Friday in the UK has changed quite a bit since Amazon introduced it in 2010. So Amazon went first, and lots of online retailers in the UK kind of followed, didn't do it very well. And then in 2013, when Asda launched a big bricks and mortar, like physical store event, lots of retailers did as well, but they did it really badly. So they discounted things way too much. They didn't really know how to manage stock. So it put huge pressure on supply chains, and they made a whole mess of it. And now they're starting to become a bit more elegant at it. And most of it, you'll notice, if you walk down our high street in the UK, there'll be a bit of Black Friday stuff, and there'll be some things on sale, but nearly all of it happens online, which is a much more sensible way of doing it. It avoids the stampedes. It avoids, I think the first time, maybe it was Sainsbury's did a Black Friday sale on tellies in the UK in the early days, and they had to call the police after people started punching each other to try and get to the cheap televisions.
Give me that sweet deal.
Sweet, sweet deals. So be careful out there if you're looking for deals. They may not be as good as they seem. Mm-hmm. And they may not make you as happy as you think they will.
And remember, 50% off is not as cheap as 100% off. So basically, don't
buy
it.
Wait, where can you get 100% off?
Yeah, where are the free deals?
Yeah, give me some of that.
Freebies.
Tune in next week to find out. Nope, probably not. We'll see you again then. Bye-bye.
Bye.